I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
A little bit of a video conference call, a little round table. It's J.G. Michael, yours truly, Casey rolling his eyes, and first-time guest, but I would say a long-time sort of online pen pal or friend, Mike Swanson of the Wall Street Window. And I should note, Mike has done a lot of work over the years, ran a hedge fund from 2003 to 2006 that generated a return of over 78% for its investors during that time frame, and was really ranked pretty highly, I think in the top 35 hedge funds among several thousand.
Yeah, way back then, but that's a whole topic. The whole hedge fund world has evolved over the years. Back then it was me and one other person, we co-managed it, but nowadays, and it was, had $5 million in it, but nowadays hedge funds, there's fewer of them in number. And they, you know, it's like ruled by ones that have billions of dollars in them, and they have computers and giant buildings full of hundreds of employees. And it's a whole different world, but that's kind of what I was hoping to, not so much hedge funds, but the financial aspects of this coronavirus thing is what I was hoping to talk with y'all, because to me, there's like two things happening at once, or three: the coronavirus, the economic recession, and then the financial markets. And it's the latter is really hidden from people, and the first two is what is making people of all walks of life, you know, focus on, no matter what your job is or whatever. Everyone's threatened by the virus and is going to experience some sort of financial impact from everything going on.
Real quick, I also have to mention, and I went and I grabbed my book right before we started recording. I love this book that you wrote, The War State. I know it's a cheap plug, but I wanted to do it because I actually do think it's a really good book. The War State. The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite, 1945 to 1963. We'll have to have you on at some point in the future to talk about that, because it's a really, really good book on the military-industrial complex. But we're going to talk, as you said, about coronavirus and the sort of financial aspects of it. It's funny, I was just reading an LA Times article about a guy who survived coronavirus but now can't find work. His name is Joey Camp, I believe. it was really depressing article to read, because he was saying, I think people are overreacting is sort of what he was saying, but it was almost like he was using that as cover. Like, he was more concerned about, like, how am I going to survive if I can't get work? So I think he wanted to believe that people are overreacting, even though there's a part of him that doesn't think people are overreacting. He's so upset about the lack of a job now, and he has every right to be.
Yeah, I mean, last night I went, I've been pretty much sitting in my house, but last night I went and visited some friends of mine, and they live in an apartment complex, and there's like 20 or 30 people almost partying, which maybe they shouldn't be doing, but anyway, a good number of them are now unemployed. In the county I live in, we have a big factory. There's a population of 100,000, but there's a Goodyear plant. They've laid off 1,500 people. All the restaurants are closed. It's like this all over the country. So the unemployment rate is probably close to 20%, if not higher. And no one knows for sure. We won't really know for another month or two. But these economists are putting out all these projections. For example, Goldman Sachs is projecting the first quarter 6% contraction in GDP and an over 20% one for the second quarter. There's a Federal Reserve official who threw out 50% for the first 6 months of the year of the entire economy, which is, I don't know, that maybe that's hyperbole, but other economists are projecting 10% quarterly contractions. But whatever it is, it's on par with, it's worse than 2008, and it's on par even with the Great Depression. From 1929 to 32, the GDP of the United States contracted 40%. So if those Goldman Sachs figures are correct, a 30% contraction in 6 months, it's pretty incredible. And I think even if we did get back to work, you know, in a few weeks, which I don't really expect, but even if it were to happen, and this fella that you're referring to is correct, that the virus is an exaggeration or the fear of it, even if we got back, things are not going to return to normal the way they were.
Well, I just wanted to add, it was interesting because it's even noted in this article. He says, you know, he used to work at like places like the Waffle House. And he's like, I just sort of want my job back. But I think even if they reopen those places, you're still not going to have as many customers coming in, because some people are just going to keep voluntarily social distancing anyways.
Yeah. In fact, I read an article the other day that in Macau, they have all 32 casinos. It's as big as Las Vegas. It's like the Las Vegas for Asia. And they shut everything down and now have reopened in the past week. And they're saying that they are having 20% of the customers that they were when, you know, before all this. So I don't know if that's because people can't get there, or just, I mean, people were financially wiped out, or just what you're saying is probably a big part of it. I mean, I don't want to go traveling to these places, you know, if I could for a while till this dies down. And I mean, I see that especially with older people are much more worried about this than younger people. I mean, the trips I've taken to the grocery store, I can tell that. But even there, you know, initially, I don't know what the numbers are now, but when this started in New York, there's some initial reports saying that people under 30 were getting hit hard by this. And I just assume it's because if that holds up, I know people in the United States, you know, eat worse than people in other countries and tend to have more health problems in that sense.
So I wanted to add something there. I've been talking to some people that are in Italy, and one of the first things they said to me and others was, it's starting to, they put it in very dark terms. They said, it's starting to take the young now too. And I don't think people realize that initially, that this isn't just affecting the really elderly.
Yeah, and myself, I'm not, I mean, I've seen the, you know, the statistics of different studies, and I mean, odds are you're going to, we're 80% of the country's going to get it. And I think it's important to try to maintain, you know, I'm not in bad health, but it, I think it's important to try to stay healthy, not, you know, you have a danger if you're just sitting down all day now, watching television, and we kind of have to choose how we deal with this. I mean, I don't want to, it would be easy to sit down and watch TV every day and just get drunk.
Right, you know? Right. Well, I know I'm seriously considering quitting smoking now, because like I've been told by like microbiologists who are like talking about this stuff, they said, oh, you smoke, you're already dead. So I like, yeah, I'm starting to take this a lot more seriously. I think all of us were not as worried about it. Most people, I think, up until maybe a few weeks ago, were like, oh, this is all gonna pass, it's an overreaction. But now I think we're in the midst of it, you know?
Yeah, and it appears, the county I live in, we have 5 cases. One person has died. And the state health director I read this morning was saying that throughout the state, it may multiply by 10 in the next week, which would be pretty shocking if that were to actually happen. Hopefully it does not. But I'm actually personally concerned, not so much about the virus, but what could happen I don't know when it was. I think the economic costs of all this are not simply a recession. So over the past few weeks, the Federal Reserve has lowered rates to 0. They are doing this quantitative easing bond buying operation, which they say is unlimited. As the stock market was declining, they announced $1.5 trillion 2 weeks ago, then another trillion a few days after that, and then last Monday, unlimited. And then last week, the Congress passed this so-called stimulus bill that's sending people, I think, $1,600 on average, somewhere $1,200, $1,600 checks in the mail or deposits in their account next month. A stimulus bill close to $1 trillion. I mean, close to $2 trillion. I think it's 1.3, 1.5. However, this isn't really a stimulus bill. It's not going to create economic growth or stimulate the economy. What it really is to keep people alive. It's to prevent collapse of the economy in a complete way, and people's, you know, starved to death or just completely wiped out. I mean, that's what it really is, and also to do the same for businesses. And of course, you know, we could probably pick it apart and attack it and figure out who's going to profit from it and all that. But the thing is, after this next month, there's no reason to think that there won't be more bills like that will be necessary as time goes on. And I do think it is necessary to give people assistance and do things when the situation is so dire. However, I'm convinced, and hopefully I can articulate why, that there's going to be a big cost to this that's not, may not appear for 6 months, 12 months, and that's going to be in inflation. So right now, people have been running to the grocery store and hoarding items. You know, I went there the other day, there was no eggs, but there's plenty of food, really. And I think people are kind of, that I think is people overreacting. I don't really believe, you know, there's some danger that the food supply is going to be disrupted or that I'm going to go to the grocery store and there just won't be nothing. And so I think people are overreacting that way. However, I am worried that at some point in the future, we're going to have, I don't know what, 20% inflation a year, or some large amount that will actually make it hard for people to buy items. And this way this bill has happened is, when 2008, that market collapse, crisis occurred, they tried to pass the so-called TARP bill, which was $1 trillion. And when it failed, and a lot of people got on the phone before that vote and yelled at their congressmen, their senators, and they voted against it. And then the stock market dumped and they voted for it. And that was history. But people were outraged at the idea of bailing out banks. This time, no one is asking any questions about really what's in the content of this, because everyone is such in a desperate situation that it's not just bailing out banks, you're giving money to everybody. So that's, and the reason I think there's going to be a lot of financial problems, as a lot of people, if you got Netflix, there's a show, I just finished watching the second season. It's called Babylon Berlin, but it's about the Weimar Republic, and in the second season, it starts out with the 1929 stock market crash and ends with it. Kind of uses that to bookcase the episode. But there's one little story in there where there's this communist girl, and her father is this leading general, you know, conservative German general, but she's a communist and she's reading Karl Marx, and she goes to a dinner with her father, and she sits next to one of the leading characters in the show that's a Nazi in the police department, and they have this kind of little back and forth. And then later on, she bumps into this guy at a coffee cafe, and he sits down and talks to her, and she tells him the whole system's going to collapse, and starts telling him Marxist theories, although it's not really, you know, it's not really explained, but anyway, that's what she's doing. And he listens to her and believes her, and goes and looks this stuff up for himself. And the point is that we're living in a time, you know, you referred that book, The War State. And when I wrote that book, I thought my parents were born in the 40s and the military industrial complex, the American empire that I was born into, they were born into it. However, I suspect that someday in the future, in my lifetime, we would see it end somehow, or something would really change. And I think that's, I'm not saying the empires, I don't really know what's coming or how, where this is all going. And that's, I'm just trying to figure out or explain what I think is happening now. And I think the next couple years are going to define the future, just like World War II did, created the era that I grew up in, and that book is about. But I think now we're entering a new chapter, and I don't know what, you know, this is just the first couple pages, and I don't know where it's heading, but the reason I think that is, I think the financial system, and I'm not saying we're going to the Nazi Germany thing, but the little thing in that show where they're saying everything is going to collapse, it's basically happened. So in the 1999, we saw the internet stocks blow up. We had a bear market. 2008, real estate blew up. And banks had these mortgage-backed securities on their balance sheets. 10% of their balance sheets were worthless. Subprime securities were nothing. That's what caused the banking crisis. And then the Fed lowered rates to zero, and the market went up for years, and now it's fallen the past couple of weeks. But the real bubble, the whole economy sort of became a bubble, I believe. And I'm going to do what that fascist character did in the show. It referred to a book that I think explains clearly. This book, I think, clearly explains it. It's written by this guy, David Harvey.
I know David Harvey. Marx Capital. Mm-hmm.
That's it. So, and I participate in the financial.
Could you hold up the book a little bit more? Yeah, just a little bit over to the left a little bit. Yeah.
That way?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think people will know it now.
And he's got, I'm going to try to, well, you probably know the book better than I do, but I've, you know, traded the markets, been a participant in them, but it's more than just the financial markets. The key concept that I want to grab from this is that, you know, libertarians talk about free markets and trade, and is freedom and stuff. But one thing they don't explain is the difference between simply trading or running a business and capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
So what is going on in what happens in capitalism, you're not just running a business and making a profit. You get these profits, and then if you've got extra profits, you have to do something with it. Mm-hmm. And you know, most small businesses don't have profits that large, but large companies do. And if you don't have places to, now what I'm saying so far, you could hear Ron Paul would be able to articulate it, but if you generate excess profits that you don't have anything to do with, or don't have something to do with in a way that makes investment sense. So let me put it this way. Say I wanted to invest in real estate.
Right.
Historically, if you invest in real estate, you want to pay it off within 7 years.
Right.
So you want to collect rent that would enable you to do that. Now, if you can't do that, then you're only betting on the appreciation of the real estate.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a very risky investment. So that's what was going on like 15 years ago. People were buying real estate, not as a rental investment, but on the bet that it's going to go up in value. Something right. was not a sensible thing to do. If you went by the history of real estate, you know, it's real estate can be a good investment, but not if you're just betting on price appreciation. Well, that is what's basically happened with the whole economy, not just the stock market and whatever. And I think one of the reasons why, which is what a Ron Paul or classic libertarian Austrian economist person would say, is, well, the Fed's lowering interest rates so low, they're making all this money available, and that creates bubbles and so forth. But I would also assert that this is part of capitalism itself. It's not simply the cause of the Federal Reserve. And to try to maybe give another example of how this affected the whole economy, the biggest thing, one of the biggest drivers in the markets and the economy itself over the past couple of years. But first of all, companies themselves, their profit margins have been shrinking already for years. So a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of talk about the companies are buying back their stock to make the stocks go up. And by buying their stocks, they're decreasing the number of shares outstanding, increasing their earnings that way in their earnings reports, but not increasing their revenue. So that's like the most easy way to see this. People talk about it. But another way this happens, which is actually more widespread, and you could find this in your own community, if you did the digging, you got chain stores everywhere, and you may have small regional chain stores. So to give an example, where I live, there was a Rent-A-Center chain called Kelly Rentals.
It's right. Like
15 rental stores.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was another business came along and said, we want to buy your business and merge. Well, they do that. Now they got something, another business with a different name, and they've got like 30 of these places. Well, let's say they borrowed money to complete this business transaction, and then they're sitting there. And then 3 years later, a bigger company comes and does the same thing. Now they're buying the business at a higher price.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple years go by, and there's this $1 billion private equity fund that says, we got to grow our earnings. We do it by buying businesses. Now they come along and they do this, but they're not paying that like you do for real estate, 7 times, you know, the value. They're paying some crazy value. And
right.
It's like, what's the word for it? It's like a pyramid scheme.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a real example that happened where I live, and there's probably, I was involved in a company that got bought out. So I know, I saw this happen, you know, I helped some people start a body chain,
mm-hmm.
a chain of body shops,
mm-hmm.
and the guy was running one body shop by himself, and then a couple of us built a couple more, and then I didn't have nothing to do with it, but they grew it to around 20 body shops, and they started going around to body shops and buying them from people that wanted to retire, and they would give them like 3 times your sales.
Mm-hmm.
And then this company came along and paid 12, which is completely crazy.
Right.
And then someone else bought it immediately from them for I don't know what price. So this was the end of what I think Harvey's explaining in his book, where
I wanted to get back to that with why you. So what about David Harvey interested you? I think that's where you were going next anyways.
Yeah. He's describing to me how this system of accumulating profit and capital creates bubbles that then completely implode, and that's just built into it. And we, I believe, are seeing perhaps the biggest bubble in American history right now blow up, and it's different. So that's why the book interests me, because he provides an explanation that I don't really see anywhere else, the why to it.
Mm-hmm.
There's other books that I've got, and I'll just cite one more. There's a book called Big Debt Crises by Ray Dalio.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this looks like.
I see.
It's a three-volume set.
Wow.
And this guy is the biggest hedge fund manager in the world. And what he does, this is like a reference book. He goes through every economic crisis through like the past 100 years that are basically debt crises. And they all kind of play out in a similar way. Not all, it's not like exactly the same, but a general pattern to it. And he predicted the 2008 crash. So from like, if you want to see what this does to markets, that's the book to look at. But he doesn't tell you the why, which I think right. The Harvey book is telling you the why. Which it's difficult, I think, you know, to interest people, at least for me, in the why of it, because most people just want to blame. The libertarians just want to blame the Federal Reserve, I believe, for the most part. So it's all caused by them, where I think the Federal Reserve is required to create a system of this type of capitalism. I think you got to distinguish between capitalism and the way libertarians, and I'm not trying to say one is better than the other or make a political argument. I'm just saying what I think is going on. I think there's a big difference between free markets as they think of it and capitalism as it exists, functions. And capitalism requires banking and central banks, and so does things such as the military-industrial complex. That's why, like, the whole, I don't know what you think of Bitcoin, but that, you know, a lot of these libertarians have this idea that if we get Bitcoin, it could replace money, and then we could replace the Federal Reserve with it. But that's not real, because big business is not going to function on Bitcoin. Big business requires the bond market to issue, you know, you go to Las Vegas or go see your Walmart. That's all these things are financed with bonds. And the bond market requires the Federal Reserve. And Bitcoin isn't going to replace that. It's just, you know, anyway, but that was more like 3 years ago. That was the fad, but.
Well, I was going to say, I think, you know, my criticism, I guess, with like a lot of libertarians, especially the more, I guess, like the Lou Rockwell, Von Mises Institute sort of types, is that I think what they're talking about is sort of this idealized system of free markets, but I don't think the type of thing that Rothbard like visualized in his head as utopia has ever really existed. Does that make sense? Like I think what they're talking about is very different from the system we live in.
Yeah, I do too. But I got in the after the internet bubble bust, Ron Paul was still a congressman, and interesting enough, what I was watching back then was he would testify and argue against, or he would argue with Alan Greenspan. They would air these Federal Reserve meetings on television, and the two critics that I would watch that would argue with Greenspan were Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders. And, you know, both of them were the ones that, when they were on TV, I'd want to watch them, you know. So, but the basic argument that Ron Paul was making was that, I'm kind of repeating myself, but I believed it was a good explanation for what I was seeing. You know, the Fed create a bubble and then they bust it, but or then it went bust. But one thing, I went back and read the Mises books. There's not all of them, but his one about the Great Depression and it's not that long. Actually, he's got one about bureaucracy that I cited it in that War State book, I believe. But anyway, his book about the Fed that he did in the 30s, the arguments were different from what Ron Paul and other libertarians are arguing today about the Federal Reserve. I only read the book once, so I don't want to, and it's been a long time, so I don't want to exactly, you know, I can't really explain it completely because I didn't even completely understand what he was talking about. But he was making an assertion that the Federal Reserve tries to control the prices that goods and commodities are at, and that by doing that, they create all these distortions, which is a different argument than most of these people are making. I'm kind of getting into semantics that aren't really important, but I guess the point of that is that if you go back to what these guys really wrote, you know, their real writings, Rothbard and Mises, you're going to find things a little different than what you know they kind of simplified or haven't read it themselves. I don't know. it's not really that important, but.
Well, Casey, do you want to chime in? Anything you want to ask?
I mean, when you started talking about stock buybacks and this inflated sense of growth, it just reminded me of the South Seas bubble or South Sea bubble. And for our listeners, that was like one of the first great depressions of the Anglophone world. Look it up. It's just a fun series of mishaps by colorful creatures. But I guess my main question at this point, and one that I've been thinking about since we started this, is how much is this neo-Great Depression is it a result of like coronavirus being a sledgehammer that's destroying the foundation of the economy, or was the foundation already weakened for the past 10 years of policies, and this is like the straw that broke the camel's back? Like, I'm reminded of a bit of an oil war going on between Saudi Arabia and Russia in the lead up to this, and a lot of anxiety in market reports around that. So I was hoping you could illuminate a little more as to the structural issues for the past 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, sure. I believe this was all going to happen one day anyway, with the financial markets and the economy in some way. However, my experience has been that these things take time to happen. Like the 2008 crash, the stock market fell for several months. It wasn't a bear market a year before the crash everyone remembers actually happened. And I was reading about the bank problems and all this for about 8 months before it all blew up. There were even articles in Barron's about it. It wasn't secret. So what is a little unique now, really, the unique factor that makes it even different than 1929 is that the speed of it. So the stock market has dropped dramatically, 30%. It has bounced last week, but until that bounce, it was actually falling at a faster rate than it did during 1929, which is absolutely incredible. So this is the sharpest, it had been the sharpest pullback in that amount of time for the U.S. stock market ever. And in all the other bear markets, I'm trying to trade this crap. So this is how I missed it, or one reason, is that all the other ones, it would make a high, come down, and then bounce back up. Well, this didn't do that at all. But the real important thing, which I think is what is really making me believe the arguments of this Harvey book, or that this is the real turning point, is that it's not just the stock market that's fallen. And in fact, more important than the stock market is the bond market has made a top and has sharply pulled back. That's what I believe the Federal Reserve is actually responding to. And this is what I think is going to create all this inflation in time, is so if you buy, like in the 2008 cycle, those mortgages were worth zero. 10% of them were worth zero, the so-called subprime mortgages. And what happened was the banks were marking them up with a fictional value, like what they last traded at, But they could, there actually were zero because you couldn't sell them, but they're putting a thing on there saying, well, we can't sell them, so we're going to say they're worth, well, this, when they weren't worth anything. Well, what happened in the stock market is that these bonds that you can buy a bond real easily. You just open up a brokerage account. You can press a button and buy a bond. The problem is you can't sell it. Most people, you buy a bond for 5 years, 6 months, and you hold it, you get your interest or whatever. But if you want to sell it, you can't do it like you can a stock. There's no one really there. So the real value of these bonds, was declining, and there's funds that hold these bonds that people buy and sell constantly. And a situation was happening where, similar to the banks, where the actual bonds were being worth less than the funds were worth. That, if that had continued or gotten worse, that could create a complete collapse or shutdown in the economic system. So that's what the Federal Reserve, when they're lowering rates and doing these bond buying programs, that's what they're stop preventing by doing it. Another thing about to link this to the virus in a different way, it might change the whole conversation, which is, might be interesting, is one thing I wonder now, since this has happened, I thought that it never really occurred to me before, and I read once Lenin's book about, I think it's called you may know the title, Imperialism, is that what it is?
Imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism, yeah.
Okay, well, I read that, I only read it once, so I'm not positive to be an expert. I may be getting it all wrong when I say this, but for what I understood, his argument was that in 1900 or so, capitalism reached like a limit of the profits it could find, so it needed to engage in imperialism to create more profits. So maybe I'm bastardizing his argument, but that's what I took from it.
And no, you're kind of right, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but other theorists at the time, I'm reminded of Rosa Luxemburg. She also posited that a similar thing to Lenin and his imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism. She wrote a critique of Marx's Kapital, which the main thesis, as you said, was that the only profit making that could go on as the markets had expanded into all the commons that existed around the world was to deepen imperial corps' connections to their periphery, to their colonies. And that is what drove the industrialized nations towards World War One, because they had all these competing markets and they couldn't trade with each other in them. And yeah, but please go on.
No, well, one thought I have is that I don't believe that argument that it required, you know, that the way I explained the Lenin thing, I don't believe that argument that capitalism requires war. However, what I do wonder now, looking back at this event, and I know about, you know, I know more about the Cold War and World War II and the 30s than I do World War One, but there's a strong argument people make that the Cold War and World War II is what got us out of the Great Depression. And the Cold War in the military-industrial complex, you know, there's an argument that's made that they were instruments that kind of prevented the U.S. from returning to recession or had some sort of stabilizing effect on the economy. But when I say this, I believe this whole virus thing is real. I don't think it's an exaggeration, the danger of it. However, I believe we really are seeing the financial system fall apart, like, you know, these more Marxist guys like this David Harvey argue. And if that's correct, then it could be that a crisis like war, actually it may be necessary at times where the financial system is imploding in order to keep it going. Like the Joseph Schumpeter has this phrase, creative destruction. So basically, if the system is collapsing, you gotta have to go through a crisis to transform it into something else. And definitely wars do that. You know, the Civil War transformed the United States. World War II did, World War I did, the Cold War did. So here's a, I believe, a strange warlike crisis that's coincidence or not, but I do think it is a coincidence, when we'll put it that way, but is going to transform the country. I don't think we're going back to normal, and it's going to enable, I mean, it's going to be different. When we come out of this, we're going to have a different form of capitalism, a different form of, you know, our world is going to be different. It's going to go on. This crisis is going to go on. I don't think it's just the virus. I think it's going to be the economy collapsing and then inflation. And then as this all plays out, we're going to be, I think the end of it, we're going to live in a different economy, a different, you know, world, different type of thinking. And I don't know if that's good or bad. I have no idea what the end result is, but war too transformed the country. You know, all these other wars did too. And I don't know if y'all are old Star Trek fans, the old show.
Yeah, yeah.
But there's an episode, I watched it over and over when I was a little kid, and there is an episode called A Taste of Armageddon in the old original series, where you had, what happened was Kirk of the Enterprise, they find this star system, it's got two planets, and I guess it was a metaphor for the Cold War at the time, but these two planets are at war with each other, but instead of wiping each other out with nuclear weapons or, you know, annihilation, they have computers, and they have a simulated war, and the simulations will spit out every day or so casualty numbers. And the people on the planet, if they are listed as a casualty, they have to go to some chamber and be killed. So what they've done is created a system in which society goes on, but they have a war without the destruction of physical buildings and the destruction of society, but you still have a lot of death. Because people are, you know, they get a casualty number, they go die. So it's real, but it's not a full out total war. And I think the virus situation is sort of a simile or a metaphor for it, because we're going to have people die. We'll find out how many around and it's all over the world. And it is causing the type of destruction or disruption, I should say, the type of disruption a war would have, mm-hmm. you know, with an economy. I mean, mm-hmm. we're not living, you know, we don't have bombs dropping on us, but the places we would go are closed up. They might as well be bombed.
Well, in a way, I think you could argue, like, we've basically moved over to a war economy at this point.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting there, yeah. I mean, we have the emergency measures now and whatnot, so yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. I mean, Trump ordered GM to... I don't know all the details, but he's ordered them to produce ventilators and look at, you know, how everyone's lives have changed. We're not in bomb shelters, but we're in shelters of our own. So, but this is a transformative event, and it's not just the virus. And I guess, you know, I went to this, as I said, to hung out with a bunch of people yesterday, and everyone is focused on what's happening in their lives, and I'm maybe because I'm lucky enough to almost be retired or could be that I'm able to think about the future. And I'm thinking out about all this economy, the threat of inflation and where this all might go, trying to think about that, how to prepare for that. And that's, you know, but anyway, that's my rambling. I don't know what do you all think of the idea that this is a like that Star Trek movie.
I mean,
if this gets us to the Federation, then I guess I'm pretty sure in the show or in one of the offshoots of Star Trek, they even said that the Federation arose as a response to a global nuclear war on Earth, and that's what precipitated the humanity uniting and making a post-scarcity sort of liberal communist, however you would describe a Star Trek world. But yeah, I think you're right. There is no going back to the previous normalcy. That this may not be the new normal, us being cooped up for all hours of the day, but our responses to this over the next 6 to 18 months are going to define like how the rest of the 21st century is going to play out. I think this is like the first real salvo in our war against global climate change, and I don't know what our odds are looking like by our response to this, but I want my co-host also put his two cents in.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, I talk to a lot of different people from like various class backgrounds, and I've had a lot of people just tell me from all different backgrounds that, you know, there is no going back to normal at this point. And I mean, I've even seen people say to me that, you know, something like the service economy or the gig economy, that's not coming back after this is over. I don't know if that's true or not, but I could see why people would say that. I mean, I think there's certain economies that are already dead. I don't know what you think of that, Mike.
Well, it's hard for me to imagine restaurants and bars are coming back. But, you know, I don't know about Uber and I don't know. I mean, bars and restaurants have been here for the dawn of man. I don't know how that's going.
No. I get you on that. I think Uber, though, I don't know what Uber is going to do. And, you know, I think there will be like massive changes.
Oh, yeah, I agree with that 100%.
Also seeing the Airbnb bubble like pop in the wake of this. Yeah. The housing, like it's kind of recurring, not recurring, it's rhyming with 2008 because we have like a housing contraction, I guess. You have less people buying properties in the midst of this crisis, but the properties are still there. Like, I'm reminded of stories out of LA where homeless people just appropriated empty houses, and I imagine those stories are going to be more frequent, if they're told at all, as these days wind on.
Well, go on.
Oh, I was just saying, I guess, you know, on a spiritual level or political level or however you want to put it, I guess it can go one or two ways. I guess it's either we realize we're more connected to one each other and the world. I mean the virus makes that's what it is. I mean, it impacts everybody. Boris Johnson now has it, and Prince Charles. Or you can go the other way and think, well, now the whole world is more dangerous, and I need to I need people to protect me from the rest of the world or something. And I guess where I live and most of the people I'm talk with locally, they are kind of falling into perhaps. That most people, I talked to all kinds of people on the internet, but where I live, most of the people are completely blaming this on China, you know, and I know that's not really true for what's going on in the United States. To me, what I feel like we're seeing is something almost like a failed state with the reaction to how, you know, the failure to deal with this. I mean, other countries have dealt with it better so far in Asia, Vietnam, South Korea, Singapore. And I mean, and maybe it's an American arrogance that I had myself, because I was following the news in China, and there were several people on the internet that I follow on Twitter that were warning about this. But they were people that are, you know, financial people that are always bearish, predicting crashes and stuff. So I just kind of saw it and it didn't register. I didn't stop to think about it. But I got two emails from people. I got a large email list and sent out stuff. And I got two emails from people in February telling me they were people I didn't know, but the stories is they both said the same thing. I know somebody that's a doctor or I know someone in this health organization and they're projecting this is going to impact the whole world, the United States and blah, blah, blah. And I just read it and I was like, oh, Jack, it's too hard to believe. And at the time I was looking for seeing evidence to confirm what I wanted to believe because China was projecting it was going to top out there. And at the time, the United States, there was 80 cases, official cases, with the CDC. But then I also read shortly after this, a story that said that the Pentagon had ordered all personnel to stay on their bases and not even travel to another one. They locked everyone down and they're still under lockdown. And I should have saw that at the time and that should have shook me up and tried to figure out what the heck is going on here. So I'm just saying maybe it's just an American arrogance and I'm even was a part of it. And it took me, I was in denial. You know, I got ahead of it more than most people, but
I don't know if I'm a privilege to say this, but you were telling me off air at one point that you had people that work in business who just felt that, this is all just to destroy capitalism. It's kind of a hoax type deal. And I'm not surprised to hear that because I think a lot of times people think, oh, people in business, especially people like really to the left of things, assume that business people don't believe in what they say or that they're being deceptive. But I think a lot of people are pretty straightforward with what they believe. And I could see business people feeling like, oh, this is just a way to destroy capitalism. These Chinese and you know, leftists pushing a hoax on us.
Yeah. I talk to, as you said, you do, I talk to all kinds of people, you know, of different social class or whatever. I don't know any billionaires personally. I've actually talked to a couple, but I don't know any, you know, actually, that is a story worth telling. So what I've found is everyone is the same. And even if you have a lot of money, it doesn't mean you actually have inside information or know anything more. And I'll give you an incredible example of that. Or two examples. Well, I'll just give one. My business is really a financial newsletter I write, and I've got all kinds of subscribers. And this one, when after Trump won, I wrote something critical of Trump the first week he was president. It seems like 100 years ago now, but it was something of foreign policy, and he fired that Flynn guy. I wrote something about that General Flynn, real critical of that character. And this fella sends me an email and he says, I just ate lunch. I had breakfast with Trump just the other week. And we see him almost every month at fundraiser meet. He's a fundraiser or donates to Trump. And I went and looked and the guy was telling the truth. You know, he had his name on there and I was able to look up who he was and he's a billionaire. But the thing about it was the tone of the email was, you don't know what you're talking about. I know Trump. And then it just had he didn't know what he was talking about. I knew more about foreign policy than this guy. And then the rest of the stuff he was saying in his email was just some crap you'd see on Fox News or something. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying the guy was talking just like anybody I know that's, you could have 50 bucks and be talking the same thing about Trump. You know, I'm just so with the business people though, saying that kind of stuff, that it's a conspiracy, or this was all fake news to get Trump. I haven't had these conversations in the past week with these people, but what I found was that, and this goes with stock market investors too, that the people that are in a risky financial situation are more apt to say those kind of things because they're desperate to believe it's not real or that things can be fixed immediately. And then if you got some guy that's got like a lot, you know, comfortable and a lot of cash and he's got no debt, they believe it's real. And they're just like, this is like 2008. They'll say, this is like 2008. I'm gonna let it all crash and I'm gonna buy real estate or something. But they think it's real. So they're all talking, not just their class. It's not so much the class position,
right,
but their
right.
personal position. You know, their personal financial position. I mean, someone who's in debt $15,000 is not much different than someone in debt $5 million. Hmm. You know, it's all, you know, they don't really, I don't know. In my experience, and maybe it's also because I live in a place where it doesn't cost much. The standard of living is low. It's already sort of had a recession forever. So rents are cheap and it doesn't cost that much to live here. So I don't know what I'm trying to tell you, but there's not that much. You know, you can live comfortably on not much money. You don't need, millions of dollars.
It's different than
as an American where I live.
I was going to say, so that's even true with Pittsburgh. I think there's a relatively comfortable, living standard here. I mean, it's cheaper than a place like New York. But I talk to my friends in New York, and they feel like they're poor because it costs so much to live in New York. But they're all making more money than most of us in Pittsburgh. So it's just like a weird situation. Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to say. That's what I'm trying to get at. So, and I looked I can't remember now, but one time I went and looked at the income levels, the bottom income, but per capita income in the country, in the counties, and the top. And where I live, I think it was like 20,000, something like that. And the area that's got the highest is Loudoun County, Virginia. It's the county that the Central Intelligence Agency is at. And there's all this defense business is there. The lowest counties are ones on the Texas border of Mexico and in South Carolina. There's a strip of places in South Carolina that's probably and as far as rural America goes, that's one of the worst places in the country, if not the worst.
Do you feel like a lot of what's happening now is, I guess this isn't necessarily related to the economy, and we'll get back to that before we wrap up. But like, how much of what we see going on around us is just like a nightmarish sort of divide between like rural and urban people in this country? I feel like there's a really deepening divide there.
Well, on an economic level, the area I live in would be an example, and this happened throughout the South. From say the 1920s to the 1970s, there was something of a boom in the South. Mm-hmm. So instead of rural America, I'm going to use them because that's what I know. But there are a lot of factories that moved to the South to escape labor unions from New England. And even here, I spoke of a Goodyear plant that shut down. You know, they've moved here in the 60s to escape unionization. But what happened in the South, the living standards were very poor. You had all these textile plants with children working in them around 1900. And then when World War II came, some of them got unions and the wages went up. But in the 70s, starting in the 70s, these places began, they tipped into recession, and they the whole area deindustrialized. So these, a lot of these factories vanished that were in the South and parts of rural America, and never came back. And that maybe, you know, this, where I live, that started, really picked up steam when Clinton was president, and never got any better. And the areas that did get better are, as you mentioned, the urban areas. So the area I live in became depressed with a lot of unemployment. Actually, there's a city next to me, 15, 20 miles away, or now it's a town, that's got the highest per capita opioid usage in the entire country per person, or the most number of pills per person. And it was a place that had a DuPont factory in World War II that shut down, I think, in the 80s. So that's the rural America I see. And then at the same time, North Carolina, Charlotte, Durham, Chapel Hill, all within 2 hours of me, they boomed. Northern Virginia boomed. So there's definitely an economic divide. And I guess that's plays out, has played out at least, in the politics, because it's obvious the rural areas are where Trump gets his most support from. I mean, where I live, the voting district, it's one of the biggest by area, one of the biggest voting districts in the whole country. In the county I live in, it's something like 65% or something. That was a massive, huge 60% of people voted for Trump. And then, you know, at the top of the county, or top of the voting district, which is near Northern Virginia, it's a lot different. So I don't know if that's quite getting into what you're thinking about, or you're thinking about a different aspect.
Well, I was thinking about what you said about, like, people you're talking to, just in your community, sort of having the "this is all China's fault" view. And I'm seeing that here in certain parts of Pennsylvania. When I go into the city, though, and talk to people that are like in the heart of Pittsburgh, that, you know, may have like the yuppie-ish jobs, they're not saying that. They're not blaming China. And I guess like what really worries me now, and maybe you were alluding to it, is I think, and I was reading a bunch of foreign policy types saying this, people like Stephen Walt. There was a New York Times article with like 15 different foreign policy thinkers saying, essentially most of them were saying that there's a potential that when this coronavirus thing is over, we're going to be moving into a much smaller, sort of more scared, more nationalistic, more like a meaner type of fucking world, excuse my French, where people don't feel connected and they're afraid of their neighbors. And by neighbors, I mean on the global level. I think we're seeing a retreat from global community.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm kind of worried about as a possibility. And well, there's two other aspects of what people are saying I haven't mentioned yet either. But I mean, a conversation I had last night with somebody was that this is all, not only is this all China's fault, but I mean, he then went on to say, once this is over, they're going to kick China out of the United Nations. And then we're going to have a war or something. I mean, yeah, this is going to be kind of really, yeah, none of, I wouldn't expect any of that to happen, but that's kind of exactly what you're talking about. And the other aspect of it, though, which is the, and again, I think this is the economy, the financial stuff, the virus, all on top of one each other. And this is that there's a lot of paranoia, and that's simply just blaming China. But one common thing I've heard people say is a hope for a miracle cure. You know, like there's going to be a drug or something in 2 or 3 weeks that's just going to wipe the whole thing out or prevent people from getting ill from it. And then Another example is I saw several people on my Facebook share a video in which this guy claims he was in the CIA, and who probably wasn't, but whatever. But the guy makes this claim that the virus isn't real. It's all a plot to destroy the economy. And then they're going to give everyone a vaccine that's going to kill people. So, I mean, it's just like really crazy stuff. So, which all these things in a way aren't new trends, you know, nationalism, kind of paranoia. I mean,
I didn't mean to interrupt you, but I was going to say, whenever people talk about paranoia, I always say Richard Hofstadter was writing about this in the 60s, the paranoid style in American politics. I mean, it isn't new, but for some reason, and maybe it's just because we have the internet, it just seems much more prevalent now.
Well, that's the difference. I mean, he was really part of what he was writing. I mean, he was writing all these things about past American history, but he was also making a political argument against Joseph McCarthy, Hofstadter, you know, when he was writing his books. And McCarthy was this, you know, nut on television or in the radio. But we mentioned before the air, I've always been interested in the Kennedy assassination. And, you know, when I was younger, the Iran-Contra affair, there's Watergate, all these scandals happened in American history, which had conspiratorial aspects to them. But the difference is, when I was a kid, I was reading about the Kennedy assassination, and just a few people I knew were interested in it. And now I go places and everyone is talking this stuff, you know, I mean, because of what's going on. So then there's a saying, like, if you can get someone to believe anything, then you can get them to follow anyone, basically. So something to that effect. So that's a danger in all this. But also, you know, one book that influenced me, and I can't even remember the title of it, but Hannah Arendt wrote a book, and not the one about the rise of totalitarianism, but she wrote a smaller book in the 60s, just like about politics and culture and stuff. It was like a bunch of essays. But one argument she made in there was that in ancient Greece, you had the forum, and all the citizens would go to the forum, and they would vote on items and stuff. But she argued that even in that environment where anyone could speak, any citizen had the right to speak. So imagine like a town, the American example would be a town hall. If we could all get 100 people in a town hall to debate on an issue and had a small community, she argued what would happen is, or what happened in Greece, was that you would still have a leader rise up, because that's just what, you know, human, you know, will be required, I guess. But the thing I really took away from what she argued was that she also said that when in that environment, like a town hall or a setting of a limited number of people, that when someone speaks publicly, that they are careful in what they say. They don't want to say something that's stupid or that's going to make themselves look foolish or bad, because then people will look down on them or not want to listen to them again. And that really stuck in my head, because we, with the internet, we have the opposite. Mm-hmm. You know, we can say anything, and you can find an audience for any message that you basically want to put out there.
Yeah, I mean, just look at this QAnon stuff.
Yeah. So, and that's a problem from the person receiving the messages too, because there's no consequences for believing stuff that is wrong or, you know, may hurt someone else. Let's put it that way. So that's a big problem in our society. I don't know the solution to it, and a danger. So when people complain about Trump or some other politician, I think the deeper problem is this, not that person. You know, I don't even, you know, the politics of all this stuff, I don't even know. You know, I think everything's broken now, or is changing, and I don't even know.
There's no sense of consensus reality or shared reality anymore.
Well, yeah, that's the problem. But I also think we're in a moment where Trump and Biden, just since they're the two people, it may not even matter so much who even wins. Mm-hmm. On one hand, and I've been myself, you know, one of these people, I guess, there's been an obsession over Donald Trump over the past couple of years, whether people love him or hate him or whatever. He's defined a lot of the discourses around him. And one thing I've watched in this crisis with this virus and the economy, but really the virus, you know, he's been giving his press conferences the past 2 weeks, making statements which I think sometimes are inaccurate, making arguments last week to open up the whole economy. And then, you know, he'll say something and some advisor will say something different or whatever. And he's been attacked for that. While at the same time, some of the people that really like him, believe him and not the people attacking him, whatever. But I came to the conclusion that what he's saying or doing is actually pretty irrelevant, because we live in a federal system of states, and this is a crisis on the state level, where it's the governors that are the main actors, and the president can't do much one way or the other.
Yeah, what is he going to do? I mean,
yeah.
Like he says, oh, we're going to end the shutdown by April 20th. Is he going to tell New York that they have to end the shutdowns? Like, what is he going to – he can't really do much, it seems like.
No. I think everything he's doing is a performance mm-hmm. for his supporters and to win the election. It's nothing really – no meaningful things are coming out of this or decisions being made. And this is the office of the presidency, and I think if Biden wins, it's going to be the same thing, that the president can't deal with this crisis. He can't really deal with the economic crisis either, and it's going to be bureaucrats dealing with that, or pressure from below if you want to see initiatives that just aren't coming out of the bureaucracy or Wall Street or corporate America. That's basically what happened in the Great Depression. You had the labor union movement grow and boom, and that's what provided pressure for Roosevelt to create Social Security and other programs and so forth.
New Deal, yeah.
The New Deal, yeah, basically the New Deal. So we don't have that in our society right now. I don't know, you know, what the future really holds. I mean, so it's a strange times. I mean, when a few months ago, when I would see Trump on TV, you know, I told a couple people, look, Trump is a president as if we were living in that movie RoboCop, you know, and it's like, this is America destroyed, and it's like, if RoboCop movie is today, you know, everything's going to shit, and the president is just some blowhard talking nonsense, and you know, that's, you know, one scenario. You know, that's what I think is really happening in a way. I haven't thought about that metaphor again, but lately, but I used to say that to people. So in a way, that's what is going on. Everything's going to crap, and this guy's just, in my view, spewing stuff to keep people, to keep his voters. But it also creates a measure of social,
dysfunction,
guess.
Well,
on one hand, it's dysfunctional, but on the other hand, it's zapping people's energy by focusing on the president whether you like the president or don't, you know, by focusing on him, you're not doing anything that's really going to improve your situation or threaten change of some sort. You're just kind of paralyzed, I believe. Mm-hmm. Whether you support, I just think the president, you know, I don't know, the office of the president, as far as domestic situations, what can it do?
It doesn't seem to matter that much.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. To me, the difference, the main reason I hope Trump loses would be the foreign policy. I mean, now it seems like 100 years ago, but that whole spat with Iran, these are not the type of policies I want to see a president do, you know? So.
Yeah. Sorry.
Go on.
I was just going to say, it's even if you can't abstract yourself away from the federal government, and I think you're right, Mike, when you say that the real agents of change, the real actors in this crisis are the governors, the mayors, the health officials, and not the president. But this crisis is also like providing a good cover, and he's doing his own covering act for like the Earn It Act, which will make online encryption nigh impossible, or union busting bills, or I saw the EPA rolling back its ability to like oversee regulations and trusting the corporations to regulate themselves. Like while we're being fed a theater from the president, mm-hmm. the actual agents of change are doing stuff behind the scenes in the corporate boardrooms and the smoke-filled back rooms and in the room where it happens, if I may appropriate Hamilton. And it's incredibly distressing, and there's no sense of transparency. That's I think the worst part about this crisis, and that's the part that's most anxiety inducing.
Well, the other thing about Trump, one of the books that came out after the election, there's one called, I got it over here, Devil's Bargain, and it was basically a profile of Steve Bannon. And Bannon, I get, although they seem, anyway, Bannon had this theory that he told the author and articulated elsewhere that what he was trying to do for years before he got with Trump and helped him win the election was create a cultural revolution in the conservative movement in the Republican Party, which, you know, it looks like he succeeded in doing. But he made the claim in this book that he believed that the Trump election was just the start of something that would take, I can't remember, he said 30 years or 50 years to complete. And I believe, you know, he didn't completely explain word by word what he's arguing there. I think what he sees is a cultural movement where Trump is a part of it, and it would go on and on and on and end up to some end point. So in that line of thought, I guess Trump or this type of movement, because it'll be passed on to someone else, whether he wins the election or not, probably his son, Eric Trump, I'm guessing, but whoever. And Bannon said he was trying to do this with Sarah Palin, like he thought she could be the person that became Trump, you know.
So I hear people saying that it could be Tucker Carlson in 4 years.
Well, yeah, that would make sense. That would make sense. But if you think of it, in his line of thought, he's seeing politics as programming people, I think. Like, you're delivering shows to them, and you're programming them to think and behave a certain way. That's no different than, that's how I thought of politics when I was a kid, what it really is. But I guess people like him are looking at this decades out. However, I would also say that no one can I don't believe history is planned out that well, you know, that leaders, no matter who they are, can plan ahead. And you know, for the studies and research I've done of presidents, and I'm doing a book about the Vietnam War, I don't think these guys are able to plan hardly anything. They're just mostly reacting to events all the time. So Bannon has these grand plans for the future. All right, I'm like, well, we'll see. You know, I don't think anyone knows where this is all going. And we can find things to worry about. And there are a lot of things to worry about. But,
well, I was going to say, you kept mentioning that there were two other aspects you're particularly worried about. What were those two aspects? You mentioned it throughout the interview.
Oh, well, just the main thing I've been worried about is the future, where there's going to be a lot of inflation as a result of the financial and economic aspects.
What would that entail?
Well,
I'm not like an econ guy, so.
Yeah, well, I mean, when people think of hyperinflation, and they think of the Weimar Republic, where, you know, that went on for longer than people realized, for like over 10 years, and literally money, you know, you'd have wheelbarrows full of money. And in reality, historically, that's like the worst crisis, okay? And the U.S. actually went through something like this after the Civil War, or during the Civil War, where the value of the greenback really went down. And most of these things happened fairly quickly, over 12 to 24 months. Basically, it plays out as a devaluation of the currency, and prices go up in value 20 to 50%. So this actually happened in the 1970s. Over that decade, prices went up about 10% a year, from like 72 to 1980 or so. So that's sort of the thing I'm worried about. Not like we're going to turn to the Weimar Republic, but that, you know, prices might go up 20% in a year at the grocery store. And these things have happened, and, you know, they happen all the time outside the United States. It's happened in Turkey 2 years ago, happened in Argentina several times, in Russia. It happened in 1998, and just a couple years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. And the most extreme case is, my mind's slipping me.
Zimbabwe, I think.
Yeah, Zimbabwe, but I mean now, in Latin America, with the Chavez, Maduro.
Venezuela, yeah.
But Venezuela is also suffering from sanctions. So the main point is that these type of crises, they're caused by the government debt exploding, and then bondholders outside the country, you know, seeing it as a default, basically, and they sell assets, they sell the currency, and the people inside the country experience high inflation. Now, the thing about it is, it sounds like, for Americans, it sounds like the end of the world. And it isn't. It's a horrible hardship to have prices go up while your income is stagnant, but it wouldn't go on but for so long, you know, 12 to 24 months, most likely. So I think we would be entering whatever the new era is that's going to define the rest of our lives.
Were there any other specific aspects that you found concerning before I let you?
No, I mean, we pretty much covered everything. I can't think of anything we missed. It's just, I don't know where things are going. And
I mean, do you have any, why, I don't want to make you speculate, but
sure.
Do you have any speculations, I guess, on where things could head?
Well, I'll say this, just you know, Trump, I don't know if it's actually a good thing or a bad thing if he were to win. Because if Trump won the election, the real hardships I see in, you know, is this inflation, I think, is going to be worse. A worse hardship than the current situation. We're sort of, at the moment, we're sort of in a stasis. You know, a lot of people have lost their jobs, but they are getting money. They're in their house. You know, it's sort of a strange situation. I think the real hardships will go on for in the future, for a year or two, with this inflation, sort of like a version of the 1970s, but worse, where you still have a bad economy, hard to get, you know, there won't be a boom in jobs or anything. I mean, it'll be better than it is at the moment, but, you know, it's going to be a bad economy. The worst we've seen in our lifetime. And whoever is the president in the next, after the election, is going to be blamed for it. So if Trump,
so if a Democrat wins,
yeah,
that would be really bad for Democrats.
It could be.
What comes after Trump for Republicans scares me.
Yeah. That's what I'm saying. So if Trump wins, I think the conservative movement will be destroyed 4 years later. And the problem with the Democrat Party is, what are they? I mean, Joe Biden is the front runner, and what is, you know, he stand for, except I'm against Trump. So the Democrat Party has a lot of problems with it and no real answers at all, even to Trump himself. I mean, they just attack him personally, try to impeach him, but they have no diagnosis of the ills of society that produce Trump. And without that, you know, and I say that, and people could argue, well, the left of the party, AOC and these people do, but they haven't caught on to control the party, much less reach the broader public, I believe. And still, it takes more than simply people running for office. You know, you need, I believe, like the labor union movement, some sort of mass movement of some sorts. And while I have one last thought on that, so where I live, even though I said this is a conservative area, there's a big difference between how conservatives organize on a local level and these progressive types. The conservative movement has been around for decades. Particularly, you know, their base of support in the rural America and places like where I live is religious fundamentalists. The issues of religion, abortion, you know, basically I could put it down to this: abortion, prayer in schools, and guns. Those are the three issues that the right wing movement is connected to on the local level in places like where I live. Now, after the Trump election, for the first time, what were they called? These people started to organize these, what's it called? What were the left-wing groups called after the election? I guess they're still around.
After 2016, or?
I
guess the progressives have the Justice Democrats now.
Well, they tried. So someone started this organization up, and they're going to create these local chapters.
The DSA?
DSA?
No, it's something else.
PSL? Like, there's a world of leftist organizations.
Democratic Party, though. Anyway, it's slipping my mind. But anyway, I mean, this was immediately after the election when they had that women's march. A lot of these people came out of that. And I know some of these people. So, I mean, I know a lot of, you know, even though there's 100,000 people here, I know people of, you know, all kinds of people. And so anyway, they organized in Virginia these sort of organizations, and some girl I went to school was organized one in a neighboring county, and then there's a guy I don't know who tried to run for office, and he did it here. And as far as I could tell, they had maybe 10 members in where I live. And they did a couple demonstrations and so forth, made a Facebook page. But our voting district is the fifth congressional district is the biggest one in the state, one of the biggest ones in the whole country. So Charlottesville, University of Virginia is there. It's in the district. And I went up there to watch someone give a speech about foreign policy, and he was being introduced by the Democrat. This was the last cycle, 2017. He's being introduced by this lady running as the Democrat, and I talked to, after it was over, the guy, one of the people that helped organize this was a guy from living in Charlottesville, two of them that were the leaders of this, what I'm calling, left-wing progressive group. And so the chapter in Charlottesville, right? So I knew someone in the neighboring county. I knew the names of the people doing this where I live. And now I go 2 hours away, even though it's in the same voting district, and I meet the guys that are running this group up there. I talk to the Congress lady. And what shocked me was that she did not know who to go talk to where I live, in the city I live in. Like, who what church should she go to try to get voters? She didn't know that. And what was even more shocking was these guys running the chapter up there, they had absolutely no communication or connection with the people in the chapters down here. Wow. So I was like, no organization at all. And of course, they probably were only doing this for 6 months, so maybe things have improved. But I'm just saying, from what I can tell, that's the state, at least a year ago, of left-wing, progressive-type politics, whereas the right, they're very well organized, and they've been doing it for decades. Now, the good thing I can say about this, I guess, if you want an optimistic view, is what happens in the past may not necessarily matter, because if you look at the history of the union movement, this city I live in, and I read a lot about textile unions that organized in the South, and this city I live in had a plant of over 10,000 people working in it during World War II, and when these guys, when the union would come and organize a plant like that, it was usually one or two people that would do the whole thing. One or two people would go there and within a few months have enough people to vote for a union. So in the civil rights movement, I talked to people that were in the civil rights movement or leaders of the civil rights movement. And it just, I mean, that's the thing. It only takes a small number of activists to make something happen, you know, and they get experience and find out how to do things. And it's all about talking to people and understanding, you know, what talking to them on their level, you know, that's what it's all about. And even though I said the conservative movement has been around for a very long time, and it's large, from what I can tell on the local level, it appears to me that it's controlled by a small number of people that are actually doing it, you know, running the whole thing.
Right. I guess in closing, what I would say, and I don't know if you would agree with this assessment, I feel like you've alluded to it, but I feel like things could go the way of like a very mean-spirited, like hyper-isolationist nationalism, not just taking hold in the U.S., but even more so just around the world, which we already see a lot of that. Or I think we could go more like the social democracy sort of way of things, or like an FDR way of things, but it's completely up in the air. that's sort of my analysis. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what I think, and I have no idea where it's going. I really don't. I don't know who's. I just don't know, and I guess that's kind of what I'm alluding to with the next election. I don't think who wins is the defining factor. It's what happens after that election, and I don't think whoever wins is going to even be that important, because I don't think they're actually going to do anything. They're more like figurehead placeholder people, you know. Even their age would suggest that.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because the concern I don't see enough people that are progressive or on the left raising is that, okay, a Democrat wins the next election, but then there's like a complete downturn in everything in terms of economics. Well, who's going to get blamed for that? It'll be Democrats. And like, as I said before, I think you could have an even worse demagogue than Trump, 4 years from now or 8 years from now. That's what scares me.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's the worst case scenario, in fact. And ironically, I read a story that made the argument, or saw a headline, I don't know how much, maybe just skimmed it, but it made the claim that Trump, I'm not going to get the phrasing right, but something to the effect that Trump wants to be an authoritarian, or he plays one, but he's not actually taking advantage of the crisis to become one. You know, he's not really, you know, all the measures that are going on are on the governor's level, but he's not really doing anything to take advantage of this in the way that Bush did with 9/11, you know. Everything
he's,
is just...
He's more incompetent.
Yeah, exactly. So, and it's amazing. I mean, well, one thing about that, it's strange. I mean, I read a lot of history and it's very strange. I mean, the funny thing about Trump is I was, over the past year, I read one or two books about Nixon and one or two about LBJ, and I've listened to some LBJ tapes, and you can see things they say or aspects of their personality that are in Trump, you know, in different ways. I mean, they're not exactly like him, but there's, especially Nixon's got the same kind of victimization feeling, you know, the media's out to get me and this and that. And
the law and order sort of mentality, yeah.
Nothing is new, you know, with Trump. I mean, except we do have, you know, these strange, or not strange, but these insider type tell-alls where he seems to be completely crazy. You know, the Woodward, Bob Woodward book, and, you know, on and on and on. Steve Bannon leaks to that, whatever that off, I forget the guy's name, but, you know, these leaks come out that make him sound like he's nuts or totally incompetent. And the failing of the media, or one of the failings, is that's how they attack him, solely on his personality. I mean, I haven't watched MSNBC lately, but, you know, I used to turn on every week, one day a week, and they'd be saying stuff like, you know, do you want this guy's finger on the nuclear button? Things of that ilk. And it's all about his personality. And no, I mean, I guess that's the one, shows like yours and other ones, that's where you get more analysis of what is actually happening.
Well, the thing is, going after his personality seems to like feed him almost. You know, it when we go after his personality, it seems like that's what gets him more and more support, because then he plays victim.
Yeah, definitely. And I've known a few people. The interesting thing about him, I mean, he obviously has some sort of narcissistic personality disorder, but people who have severe personality disorders, or maybe I should use the word severe, but most people like that are, he's unique, because I've only met two people that have a lot of money and are narcissistic like that. Mm-hmm. And one of them was a complete like con artist. Mm-hmm. And the other one, I wouldn't say he's a con artist, but both of them acted the same way. They would talk and talk and talk. It never really let you, they wouldn't care what you had to say. It was all, you know, nonstop talking to try to convince you that the image that they were portraying was real, to try to con you or convince you to do something. And in one of these people, this is a whole nother conversation, but one of these people, of these two I knew, he was a pioneer in the pickup women movement. I think this is all gone now, but there is this niche on the internet of buying books to teach you how to pick up women. And
the one I remember is there's a guy, Roosh V, who was like, he's one of these like PUA guys. He was really out there. He was like, I think he was like pro rape and stuff. Now he's like just some crazy like traditionalist Catholic. So I do think luckily that movement is dead.
But anyway, this guy was a student of NLP.
Neuro-linguistic programming.
Right. Yeah. Right. And what he would do is use that, the pickup stuff and this neuro-linguistic programming, what became not just how he would try to talk to women, but how he talked to everybody all the time. And I would bet money, if I could, that Trump is a student of this stuff. Because I noticed when he was running for president, he uses these type of NLP phrases and things. For example, the core basis of it is you're supposed to use metaphors to suggest things and not quite outright state them. So during when he was running for president, he had a debate with a guy from Texas, that really creepy senator. Anyway, the guy said something against Trump, and then Trump went back at him and talked about the Twin Towers falling, the 9/11 terror attacks, and said something that you said is just as bad as that, and it's smoky. I'm not repeating it in a way that makes it work, but he was saying something to try to link his opponent to dirt and bad smells and things. But he does this all the time in the way he talks.
You meant Ted Cruz, I think, yeah, right?
Exactly. That's
yeah, him. Yeah, yeah.
Ted Cruz. That's it. You can find this on YouTube, Ted Cruz debate with Trump. But he says something very strange. I guess that's the reason he's doing the same thing when he attacks people by their appearances and things like that. But I think that what has happened with Trump and like these two people I knew that, you know, were financially successful is that they get caught up in this type of acting to everybody, and they can get away with it because there's no financial repercussions or people just put up with it. And then they start to delude themselves. And they can't break out of this. I mean, now I'm psychoanalyzing.
I think there's truth to it. And the only other comment I'll make is it's really weird with Donald Trump. One of the things he does with his base at those rallies is, and I don't think most people pick up on this, but part of the whole Make America Great thing is there's almost like a masochism to it, because he's saying, you guys are losers. You know, he's basically telling his own base, you guys are losers, and you need me to make you great again. But he's like openly sort of like telling them, you know, you suck, and you need me to like fix everything for you. There's sort of like he's browbeating them in a way.
Yeah, I think that's true. I know someone who, this was a funny conversation. I know two people that went to Trump rallies, and one of them spoke at it. He is a preacher, pastor, And he gave the opening prayer because the rally was taking place, I guess, near where he lived, and he had a connection to someone organizing it, whatever. But he told me when he gave the prayer, he said everybody stood up, and he never felt like that before, you know, like he was in control of the crowd just by giving this opening thing. And then a friend of mine went to one in North Carolina, and I said, well, what was it like? You know, what was it like? And the guy said, well, it was the most intense experience I ever had. That's what the guy told me. And I said, well, how's that? He said, well, I went to it, and before it began, he tripped on mushrooms during the event. And but it wasn't the mushrooms that made it intense. He just said it was the most intense thing he'd ever been to. And he made a comment like, I'm not really, which may fit with what you're saying, this guy supports Trump, but he made a comment like, I'm not with the Trump people. You know, so there may be
I'm definitely going to add taking psychedelics and going to a political rally on my bucket list now, because that sounds like a trip.
But I can see, you know, that might be the best way to understand what exactly the Trump movement is about at its apogee.
Yeah, there's like a self-loathing to it in a way, probably.
And even told me about, I'm not with the Trump people. I'm not with, you know, I don't believe, you know, I'm not with them all, but he likes Trump. What does that mean? Sort of what you're saying. Mm-hmm. This guy attends the rally, but doesn't like the people there. Mm-hmm. But he, you know, likes Trump. So it's sort of what you're saying. You know, Trump's browbeating, I'm not with the losers, I guess, could be a way to interpret what he's saying.
Well, hey, I've kept you long, Mike. I want to let Casey ask you, you know, a question or any comments to close out, if you had anything you wanted to ask Mike.
I really don't have any additional questions. I think this we've drawn as much as we can out of you, so now let's put it out for the world to see. I hope you and your family are doing well in this crisis, and I don't know, stay safe, stay strong, solidarity forever.
Thanks, yeah, good talking with y'all. Y'all have a good day.
Awesome. So I stopped recording. Thank you.